It. Well, all right. But don't hit the surf alone.
I never do. And it's too cold, anyway. She remained in bed for 15 minutes after her parents left, to be certain they were gone. A short while later, as she sat at the kitchen table, finishing a breakfast of chocolate milk and Eggo waffles smeared with peanut butter, she began to tremble, and then to shake uncontrollably,
as if the hinges of her bones had come loose every one and all at once.
She didn't ask herself why the shaking. She didn't want to know why. It wasn't about a ghost, either real or imagined. Ghosts couldn't harm her. Even if it had been a real ghost in the attic, she would most likely never see another. Ghosts didn't swoop up every day from all around, like sparrows and meadowlarks taking wing. If something else happened in the high room, some moment of insight or even revelation, it had been of so little importance that it had evaporated from memory while she'd slept, before her mother woke her. She insisted that she just had a chill. That was all. That was enough to explain the shakes. Leaving the last few bites of the meal on her plate, she went into the living room, where the gas fireplace featured an electronic ignition. She switched it on with a remote control. Hands thrust in the pockets of her jeans, she stood at the hearth, basking in the heat, staring into the blue and yellow flames that leaped around the ceramic logs. Sometimes, she liked to search for animals and faces in the shapen clouds of a summer day. Flames were too quick and fluid for the eye to glimpse the suggestion of any presence other than fire, and that was a good thing. When the shakes passed, she decided to walk to the park along Ocean Avenue and sit on the bench at Inspiration Point, even if the fog still largely obscured the Pacific. The sea always calmed her, even just the scent of it, and the soothing sound of waves dashing against rocks and splashing across the sand. But as she stepped onto the front porch, even before she pulled the door shut, an unexpected flood of tears spilled from her. She wasn't a girl who wept in front of others, and she retreated into the bungalow. She didn't wish to understand this bitter emotion any more than she had cared to analyze the cause of her shaking. She wanted only to stop crying, to shut off the flow before it might wash into view a reason for this grief, if it was grief, or this dread, if it was dread. When she realized that the tears might be as persistent as the shakes, she ran for the only medicine that reliably cured any bout of unpleasant feelings, a book. Although her mother thought that Bibi had stayed up all night reading The Secret War in the Garden, which was the third young adult novel in a beloved fantasy series, she hadn't yet begun the story. Now she snatched the book off her nightstand, hurried with it to the living room, switched on a floor lamp, dropped into an armchair, and sought refuge in the tale. The first rumors of war came from the field mice, who traveled daily between the garden behind the Jensen house and the world below, which was far larger than our world and still unknown to most people, though known to certain children. At first, as Bibi read, she wiped her tear-streaked face with the sleeves of her sweatshirt. Soon, however, the blurred print became clear, and her eyes stopped sabotaging story time. And so it was that hour by hour, day by day, she moved away from the disturbing knowledge that she needed to put behind her. The eerie and unsettling experience in the attic became about nothing more than an apparition or hallucination. She rejected the revelation that had been part of the incident, cut it from the cloth of memory, and sewed shut the hole it left. Or thought she did. She read books and wrote stories about Jasper, a black and gray dog who had been abandoned by his owner and sought a new home along the coast of California. A couple of weeks later, when a golden retriever came to her out of the rain, she kept him and named him Olaf. As kids do, she made a confidant of her dog and told him all her secrets, as she knew them. She told him about Captain, how wonderful he had been. She told Olaf that the apartment above the garage was an evil place. But she didn't tell him why. Chapter 28. A Visit from the Doctor. Bibi had folded the pajamas and the robe into her drawstring bag and had donned the jeans and long-sleeved t-shirt she'd been wearing when Nancy had brought her to the hospital. This was an expression of confidence in her belief that the brain cancer had gone into remission, that the glioma hadn't merely shrunk, but had vanished. When Dr. Sanjay Chandra entered the room, Bibi was pacing, not to work off a bad case of nerves, but with impatience to get back into the world and reclaim her life. He halted at the sight of her, and his expression was so solemn that something caught in her throat, as if she had tried to swallow a large bite of meat without chewing it, though she hadn't eaten anything. What appeared to be solemnity, or even distress at the news he had to deliver, proved to be awe. "Nothing in my years of practice, nothing in my life, has prepared me for this. I'm not able to explain it, Bibi. It's not possible. But you are entirely free of cancer." The previous day, Nancy had said that Dr. Chandra reminded her of Cookie, the gingerbread cookie that had come to life in an old children's book that she had shared when Bibi was 5 years old. The resemblance owed more to Nancy's sense of whimsy than to fact, and it certainly wasn't so pronounced that some snarky magazine would pair Dr. Chandra's and Cookie's photographs in a separated-at-birth feature. However, everything about the physician, his boyish face, chocolate-drop eyes, musical voice, humility, and charm, made her want to like him. Upon his confirmation of remission, she loved the man. She flew to him like a child into the arms of an adored father. "Thank you, thank you, thank you," she gushed, exhilarated even as she was embarrassed by her exhilaration. He returned her embrace and then held her at arm's length, his hands on her shoulders, smiling broadly and shaking his head slowly as if marveling at her. "The first diagnosis wasn't mistaken. You did have gliomatosis cerebri." "I'm sure I did. I know I did." "Other tumors can break down and be absorbed, and the remission can be surprisingly quick. It's not common, but it does occur. Except with this cancer. Never with this hateful thing. I'll want to see you for follow-up. Quite a lot of follow-up." "Of course. Oncologists specializing in gliomas will want to study you." "Study me?" "I don't know about that. I don't think so." "What is it about you that made the impossible possible? Is it genetic? A quirk in your body chemistry? A higher functioning immune system? Studying you might save uncountable lives." She felt irresponsible for having shied away from the prospect of being studied. "Well, if you put it that way, I do. I put it that way." He released her shoulders. His happy expression was infused with wonder again. "Yesterday, when I said you had at most a year to live, you said, 'We'll see.' Do you remember?" "Yes." "It's almost as if you knew then that you'd go home today." Chapter 29. The Poison Ivy Itch of Intuition. Because Nancy and Murphy were coming for a long visit at 4 o'clock, Bibi hadn't called to tell them what had happened in the night, or that her death sentence had been miraculously commuted. Although she'd known that her health had been restored, she hadn't wanted to pop the champagne cork with them, figuratively speaking, until she had Dr. Chandra's confirmation. Besides, she wanted to see their surprise, their disbelief, their joy, when they walked through the door and saw her in street clothes, her former glow restored. 15 minutes before Bibi's parents were due, Chub Khoi, chief of security, peered through the open door. His pale blue shirt with epaulets looked fresh, and his dark blue slacks still held a sharp crease. He said, "Got a minute?" Rising from a chair by the window, Bibi said, "Suddenly I have millions of minutes." Failing to match her smile, Koi entered the room.
"Since I spoke to you last, we've quick-scanned the parking lot video for the past 24 hours. No Mr. Hoodie. No Golden Retriever. Seems they didn't drive here or walk. And I'm not a guy who believes in crap like teleportation. What about you? You believe in teleportation?"
"What? No, of course not."
"So I asked myself, did they come here more than a day ago and hide out in the building? Are they still hiding in the building?"
"Why would they do that?" she asked.
"Damn if I know."
He shrugged and looked bewildered, pretending for a moment to be without suspicion.
"So we searched the place, end to end. Nada, zip."
He walked past her to stare out the window, head tipped back, pondering the sky.
"It makes me feel stupid, you know? So I kept looking at the same scrap of video till I noticed something weird. Wanna guess what it was?"
"I have no idea." Still at the window with his back to her, Chub Koi said,
"When the guy and the dog come along, they pass two other people going the opposite direction. A nurse, then an orderly. Neither one glances at Mr. Hoodie. Kind of peculiar, huh? That hour, the hoodie, and not even a glance. But stranger still, here's this beautiful dog at 4 in the morning, and they don't glance at it either. People see a beautiful dog, they stare. They smile. Most want to pet it, ask the owner its name. They're off duty now, the nurse and the orderly, so I called them. Both swear there wasn't a dog. They're adamant. They never passed a dog in the hallway. You know what I'm wondering now?"
"I don't have a clue," Bibi said. "I'm sure you'll tell me." He turned from the window to face her.
"I don't know how it's possible, but just about anything is these days when it comes to fiddling with digital recordings, sound, or image. So I'm wondering if some hacker breached our security archives, somehow inserted Mr. Hoodie and the dog in our video, made them be where they never were."
Perplexed, Bibi said, "Who'd go to all that trouble, and why?" Instead of answering her, Chub Koi said,
"Watching it about 100 times, I still can't see any technical giveaway. The guy and the dog register with the same clarity as the nurse and orderly. The light plays off them exactly as it does other people in the scene. But I'm no expert. A first-rate techie specialist, an analyst with the right credentials, should be able to prove it's a fraud."
"Except for one thing you seem to have forgotten," Bibi reminded him. "I saw them. The man, the dog. They came into my room. The dog stood on its hind feet, put its front paws on my bed. Those lovely, luminous gold eyes. It licked my hand." She held up her left hand, as though a residue of case-closing golden retriever DNA might still be found between her fingers. The security chief's blue-flecked, steel-gray eyes were to him as scalpels to a surgeon. Direct and sharp and intent on cutting through all deception, his gaze seemed to flense her with exquisite delicacy, peeling away the layers of her image in a search for the most artful chicanery, some subtle telltale that would put the lie to everything he'd been told.
"These days,"
he said in a dead-flat voice from which he took care to bleed all inflection,
"I may be just a glorified mall cop in a somewhat more respectable environment, but I was once the real thing, and I still have good gumshoe instincts."
Regarding him with growing amazement and uneasiness, Bibi asked, "What are you saying?"
"I'm not saying anything, Miss Blair."
"That I'm some kind of suspect?" He raised his eyebrows and widened his eyes in an unconvincing pretense of surprise, as if she had misinterpreted what he'd said and had leaped to a conclusion about his intentions that astonished him. "What am I supposed to have done?" she asked, not with offense or anger, but with a kind of amused bafflement. "Faked the remission of my cancer?
Tricked the MRI machine? Deceived all my doctors? Does any of that make sense?
If the irrepressible joy she felt as a result of her recovery hadn't been still so fresh in Bibi's heart, the security chief's smug smile would have ticked her off.
That old cop intuition, Miss Blair. It's like poison ivy. It just itches and itches. You can't ignore it. So you have to scratch it real good to get relief.
With those words, which Bibi took to be a promise or even a threat, Chub Coy headed for the door. She said,
"Try some calamine lotion. It has a funny smell and it's lady pink, but it relieves the itching."
Without glancing back, Coy left the room. The soft laugh that escaped Bibi had only a slight nervous edge. She said, "Looney Tune." Chapter 30. Proud Collector of 10,000 Heads. Throughout the morning and the afternoon of their first day on the roof of the three-story building, the four members of the SEAL team used periscopic cameras with non-reflective zoom lenses to scan the dead village without much risk that sunlight, flaring off the glass, would betray their presence. The images transmitted to the display screens were crisp, clear, and tedious. When the sun moved west, but not directly behind Paxton and his men, they were bold enough to poke just their heads above the parapet to study the townscape. A drab, gray, and sand-brown hodgepodge of characterless structures, bullet-pocked stucco, cracked and crumbling concrete, and iron security gates hanging useless from broken hinges, strewn through the rubble. Their target, the ghost, whose name was Abdullah al-Ghazali, was holed up somewhere in these grim ruins, and he had with him six acolytes, all true believers, two of them possibly women. He had chosen to hide in this town, whose population he had slaughtered 17 months earlier, perhaps because he thought it was the last place anyone would look for him, but perhaps because the atmosphere of an abattoir appealed to the bastard. Surrounded as he was with memories of vicious cruelties and abhorrent violence, which he found delectable. Paxton had studied the culture that produced such men, but a lifetime of study wouldn't help him understand why they became death-loving haters of everything the rest of humanity held dear. An equal opportunity terrorist who murdered not only Jews and Christians and Hindus and those who had no faith, Abdullah al-Ghazali also butchered Arab tribes other than his own. Muslims he considered less than pure. He claimed to have taken, or ordered taken, the lives of 10,000 people. And most experts thought he had undercounted. He usually moved with impunity through countries impressed by his barbarism, but not since the past October. In spite of homeland security and no-fly lists and surveillance of every transportation system coast to coast, he had gotten into the States, activated 10 sleeper cells, planned two attacks, led one, on shopping malls, and murdered 317 people. Most of his associates had been killed or arrested, but he had escaped the United States, only to find that he was now too hot to be welcomed in those kingdoms and fake democracies that had once provided him with rent-free villas when he needed them. Pax, Danny, Gibb, and Perry had been sent to provide justice, which in this case did not require a judge and jury. Now that they were in town, they were eager to do the job and go home, impatient with the need to conceal their presence until the targets revealed themselves, instead of boldly going on the search. Later in the afternoon, only half a block away, a man appeared on the flat, railed roof of a two-story building on the farther side of the street. Although he was dressed in gray to match the concrete around him, his camouflage was pathetic. A pair of binoculars hung around his neck. The SEALs at once put down their field glasses and ducked out of sight. Perry raised a camera on its stick so that it barely cleared the parapet wall. The instrument was so small, there was little danger that the watchman would spot it. Perry and Pax lay with a display between them, watching an enhanced image of the terrorist. Not Abdullah. one of his butt kissers. The guy lit a cigarette and took two draws before raising his binoculars to survey this jumping-off place that he and his companions used as their rat's nest. Having put up a second camera, Gib and Danny huddled over that display. Four men scoping the scene, analyzing the smoker's behavior, were better than two. Each might see a crucial detail that the others missed. For starters, Pax figured the six targets must feel safe if one surfaced only periodically to perform a cursory surveillance of the town. Maybe their edge had worn off because they were doing good dope, which, among their teetotaling kind, was a common indulgence. Mass murder was stressful. They had to chill out somehow, after all. 317 shoppers, 10,000 victims. Back when Muammar Gaddafi had ruled Libya, the ghost had done an American TV interview from a villa there, in which he'd said, in addition to the usual propagandist rant, that he possessed a small collection of severed heads in one of his residences. The heads, he declared in his taunting manner, were much like books on a shelf, each one a story. He wished that he had a library large enough to hold 10,000. Throughout the day, Pax had thought often about Bibi, worried about her, wondered about the vivid image of her that had thrust into his mind the night before. Now, she receded to a back corner of his thoughts. A job needed to be done. He and his guys would do it as well as it could be done, and with considerable satisfaction. Chapter 31. Crazy When You Least Expect It. Nancy and Murphy didn't know whether to laugh or cry. And as usual, when torn by conflicting emotions, they succumbed to both, switching back and forth, and back again, from tears of joy to tears that watered a large garden of what might have happened fears. They made such a spectacle of themselves in the hospital room that a nurse stepped in and politely asked them to remember, please, that the other patients needed peace and quiet. As soon as Bibi had the discharge papers, her parents shepherded her along the corridor, into the elevator, down to the lobby, out to the parking lot, both of them often talking at the same time. They had 1,000 questions, and they wanted to hear everything that had happened, but they weren't able to stop themselves from interrupting her with hugs and kisses and exclamations of relief, some in surfer lingo, epic, boffing, totally sacred, just a pure glasshouse pipe of a day, stylin'. Which, for the first time, sounded wrong coming from them, as though their daughter's flirtation with death had made them desperate to be young again. Dinner had to be special, celebratory, a night to be remembered forever, an amped-up commemoration of the impossible become possible. Bibi knew too well what that meant. The best combination Mexican and burger joint in town, where cheese came on everything and the spices were hot, hot, hot. Too many bottles of icy Corona, too many shots of tequila. But she went along with the plan because she was hungry, happy, still afloat on wonder, and because she loved her mom and dad. They were always sweet, always amusing, and they weren't alcoholics, only special occasion drunks once a month or so. During the dinner, Nancy whispered in Murphy's ear and left the table for 10 minutes. When she returned, giggling, Murphy whispered in Nancy's ear. Then he went away for 10 minutes. They were clearly conspiring at something, and Bibi half dreaded what it might be. They were generous and thoughtful, but a surfeit of emotion and too much booze could be a wicked combination that motivated them every so often to drop upon their daughter a wildly inappropriate gift. To observe the publication of Bibi's first novel, they'd presented her with an illegal tiger cub, which seemed reasonable to them because one of the big cats was a featured player in the book. Of course, she'd contacted animal welfare authorities, pretended to have found the cub in the park, and made sure that the little fellow went to a first-rate refuge for exotic animals. She didn't want another tiger, or, God forbid, an elephant, but she said nothing, because nothing she said would stop them once they had agreed on a perfect gift. Her parents could hit you with crazy when you least expected it. Bibi had drunk little beer and no tequila while convincing Nancy and Murphy that she was keeping pace with them. Now she insisted they couldn't drive her to her apartment. She would take them home and, in the morning, return their BMW.
They snuggled in the back seat as if they were teenagers. At the house in Corona del Mar, their attempt to disentangle and clamber out of the car was worthy of Ringling Brothers' finest trying to exit a joke vehicle the size of a riding lawnmower.
Nancy paused in that performance to say, "When you get home, angel girl, just go with it."
"Go with what?"
Grinning, her dad said,
"You'll see."
"Oh, no. I didn't think it would be tonight."
"It's just what you need," Murphy assured her.
"What I need, Dad, is a hot bath and bed."
"Her name's Callida Butterfly."
"Whose name?" He closed the door and bent down with Nancy to grin at Bibi through the front passenger window. The two of them waved and blew kisses, as though she hadn't been dying just the day before. As if she were 18 and going off to college. It'll be what it'll be. And it had turned out to be some kind of miracle. Even if the good twist might be impossible, inexplicable, Nancy and Murphy would, by morning, have put all the recent stress and worry behind them, would waste no psychic energy on wondering why or what if. They would grab their boards and hit the beach, so to speak, and respect fate by giving no thought to it until they were slammed by the next thing that would be whatever it would be. On the drive to her apartment, Bibi repeatedly reminded herself that, having had her ticket taken away and torn up as she waited on the banks of the River Styx, she should be grateful for every breath and accept every annoyance and frustration with patience. Easier said than done when someone named Callida Butterfly was apparently waiting for you with just what you needed. She parked in one of the two spots reserved for her apartment and switched off the headlights, but not the engine. She considered putting down the power windows an inch to provide ventilation and sleeping in the car. That was a childish impulse. She hadn't been a child even through much of her childhood. She shut off the engine, but took no satisfaction in her maturity. In the apartment complex courtyard, in the expectant stillness of the night, the palms and ferns were as motionless as plants in a diorama. Ribbons of steam rose and withered from the heated, eerily illuminated pool, and a young man as sleek as a trout swam laps so effortlessly that his arms sliced from the water only a quiet slish, slish, slish. Carrying her drawstring bag and laptop, Bibi climbed the open iron staircase to the long balcony that served the third floor units. When she came to the door of her apartment, she found it open wide. Beyond the threshold and the shallow foyer, extravagant bouquets of red and white roses dressed the living room, as if a wedding would soon commence. And all the shimmering light issued from candles in glass cups that crowded every surface not occupied by flower vases. As Bibi hesitated in the foyer, a woman stepped into view from the right. She wore flat-soled white shoes, white slacks, and a short-sleeved white blouse. She might have been taken for a physical therapist or a dental assistant, except for the blue silk sash that she wore as a belt, the gold star on Bluefield silk scarf at her throat, dangling silver earrings, each ear with three hoops of different sizes, and enough expensive-looking bracelets and finger rings to stock a jewelry store. She was an Amazon, 5'10", maybe 6 feet, formidable but feminine, with a face reminiscent of Greta Garbo, if Greta Garbo had looked a little more like Nicole Kidman. She was about 40, with clear, smooth skin, blonde hair cut in a pageboy, and eyes that were blue or green or silver-gray, depending on how the quivering candlelight revealed them. In a voice both slightly husky and melodious, she said,
"I am Callida Butterfly. Welcome to this first day of your new life."
Except that her parents were more traditional in some things than they believed themselves to be. Except that their beloved and otherwise libertarian surf culture didn't have much patience for woman-woman or man-man romance. Bibi might have thought that their gift to her would turn out to be her first lesbian experience. But of course, it was far different from that. She was about to learn why she had survived brain cancer. Part 2. Girl with a Mission. Girl on the Run. Chapter 32. Solange St. Croix and the Butterfly Effect. Kalida Butterfly traveled with a folding massage table and a small ostrich skin suitcase. Featuring two compartments, the case could be opened from either side. Half of it contained the lotions, oils, and items related to massage. The other half held things she needed for her second occupation, which she had declined to reveal until she completed working on Bibi's tense, knotted muscles. "If you're thinking about what comes next," Kalida had said, "you're not getting the full effect of the massage." "If I'm wondering about what comes next and why you're being so mysterious," Bibi had replied, "that won't relax me either."
"The writer that you are. I guess you're used to being a kind of dictator, telling the characters in your stories what to do."
"It doesn't work that way."
"Good. It doesn't work that way with me either."
Taking off her rings and bracelets, she said,
"Now you lie down and be a good girl."
Holding a towel across her breasts, wearing only panties, Bibi had done as she was told. Her embarrassment passed quickly because of Kalida's brusque yet reassuring manner. An uneasiness remained, but she couldn't identify a cause. Maybe it was a lingering effect of the cancer scare, the residue of concerns that need no longer worry her. The table had a cutout for her face, so that she was looking at her living room carpet, where reflections of candlelight flowed and wimpled almost like water. "Did you bring all the candles and roses?" Bibi asked as she waited for the massage to begin.
"Heavens, no. Your parents asked me to have them delivered at the last minute. I can get anything done on a 2-hour notice."
"How do you manage that?"
"I have sources. Proprietary information. Now shush."
Kalida switched on an iPod. Israel Kamakavivo-Ole, whose voice was one of the warmest ever recorded, began to sing a soothing medley of Somewhere Over the Rainbow and What a Wonderful World. "How did you get in here?"
"Your mom has a spare key, right? She put it in an envelope and left it with the hostess at the restaurant. I picked it up."
About 5 seconds after the first touch, Bibi realized that Kalida Butterfly had magic hands. "Where did you learn this?"
"Do you ever shut up, girl? You be quiet and just float."
"Float where?"
"Anywhere, nowhere. Quiet now, or I'll tape your mouth shut."
"You wouldn't."
"Don't test me. I'm not your ordinary masseuse."
In spite of the faintest uneasiness, Bibi got with the program. The candlelight purling and undulating on the carpet proved hypnotic. Just as she began to float, she wondered if the woman massaging her was, in fact, Kalida Butterfly. Someone could have disabled the real Kalida, or even killed her, taking her place in order to...
to what?
No. Such a twist was a novelist's conceit, and not a good one. Bad thriller plotting. Or a movie with shrieking violins and the latest scream queen channeling a young Jamie Lee Curtis. The rippling, curling candlelight. The music. Kalida's magic hands. Soon, Bibi was floating again. Floating anywhere. Nowhere. Somewhere. Gelson's supermarket. An express checkout lane. 7 months after she had dropped out of the university. Bibi was puzzled that memories involving Dr. Solange St. Croix Such old news, after all, should trouble her twice in 2 days.
That afternoon, 3 years earlier, she stopped at the market for a head of lettuce, a few ripe but firm tomatoes, radishes, and celery. Carrying everything in a handbasket, she recognized her former professor standing last in line for the express checkout. Her first inclination was to retreat, explore a few aisles even though she needed nothing more, waste enough time for the Holy Mother of the University Writing Program to make her purchases and leave. The encounter she'd had with the woman in that minimalist office with the half-empty bookshelves had left, however, an enduring sore spot on Bibi's ego. She always stood up for herself, never pig-headedly, never without good reason. But on that occasion, she had backed down with uncharacteristic wimpiness, shocked and confused and unsettled by the professor's inexplicable fury. If she withdrew now, hiding out in the bakery department, she would suffer a second blow to her self-respect, this one more deserved than the first. To be honest, there was another consideration. In the 7 months since leaving the university, living with her parents, she'd written 6 short stories. 3 had been accepted for publication by the Antioch Review, by Granta, and by Prairie Schooner. Such prolific production and acceptance were remarkable for a writer not yet 19. In one of the smaller rooms of her heart, Bibi harbored the unworthy desire to share her success with her former professor. She stood in line behind her target, telling herself not to force the moment, to wait for the woman to notice her. She wouldn't take a snarky tone when disclosing her good fortune. Striving to sound sincere, she would thank the professor for all she had learned in those 3 months, as if being harried out of the university had been a valuable service, had awakened her to her faults, and had brought her to her literary senses. She would be so convincingly humble and ingenuous that Solange St. Croix would be left speechless. The professor's handbasket contained 9 items, and when her turn came at the checkout conveyor belt, she turned to her left to unload her purchases. She saw Bibi from the corner of her eye and turned to face her with an almost comical expression of astonishment. The woman seemed to be wearing the same outfit as on the day in her office when she'd breathed fire, a tailored but drab pantsuit, and a blouse the gray-green of dead seaweed. Her graying hair was still in a bun, her face without makeup, and her blue eyes were cold enough to freeze her opponent in a smackdown with the mythical Medusa. Before Bibi could get out a word, the professor said, "You bold little bitch!" Spraying spittle with the bees, and her face contorted with what seemed to be both anger and fear. "Following me. Stalking me." Before Bibi could deny the charge, the woman rushed on. "I'll call the police on you. Don't think I won't. I'll get a restraining order, you crazy c—" In the river of invective that followed, she used the C word, the T word, the F word more than once. And it was impossible to tell whether rage or genuine terror scored higher on her emotional Richter scale. "Get this girl away from me! Someone help me! Get her away from me!" 3 shoppers had stepped into line behind Bibi, making retreat a clumsier bit of business than she would have liked. Maybe they knew who the esteemed professor was, or maybe she looked so unthreatening and widow-like that, in spite of her foul language, they were inclined to sympathize with her. On the other hand, customers and clerks and aproned bag boys stared at Bibi, gaped at her, as if she'd committed an offense against the helpless older lady that, although witnessed by none of them, must have been malicious in the extreme. With St. Croix still asking for help and warning everyone about her dangerous assailant, Bibi made her way among the shoppers in line behind her and turned left, crossing the front of the store. Rattled as she rarely was, mortified, she didn't know where she was going. That is, until she put down her handbasket of vegetables on a display of Coca-Cola, said, "Excuse me," to a young mother and child with whom she collided, and headed for the nearest exit. So much for floating.
You tensed up all of a sudden,
said Kalida Butterfly. Just a bad memory.
Men,
said the masseuse, making a wrong assumption.
Nothing we can do about them, except shoot them, if it was legal.
Bibi hadn't gone back to Gelson's for a year, although it was her favorite market. Even to this day, she imagined an employee now and then recognized her, and, to be safe, kept out of her way. She hadn't seen Dr. Solange St. Croix since, hoped never to see her again. With no slightest clue to puzzle out the reason for the professor's bizarre behavior, Bibi had decided it must be early-onset Alzheimer's. A draft stirred the candle flames for a while, and fluttering cascades of soft amber light spilled across the room, which smelled sweetly of roses. Bibi took slow, deep breaths and exhaled through the face hole in the massage table.
That's better, Kalida said. Much better.
A few minutes later, she said,
We're done with this part, kid. Now, let's find out why you were spared from brain cancer.
Chapter 33. Waiting for the wrong people to show up. Fully dressed, feeling pleasantly wrung out, Bibi opened a chilled bottle of Chardonnay, poured two servings, and brought the glasses to the chrome dinette table with the red formica top. Kalida Butterfly had moved some of the candles from the living room and distributed them on the table and countertops to provide the proper mood for the second thing that she had been hired to do. Laying her ostrich skin suitcase on one of the chrome and black vinyl chairs, Kalida said,
Do you know what divination is?
Predicting the future, Bibi said.
Not entirely. It's also a tool for uncovering hidden knowledge of supernatural means.
What hidden knowledge?
Any hidden knowledge, Kalida said, as she opened the half of her suitcase that didn't contain items related to massage therapy.
I don't believe in prognostication, all that stuff. Kalida wasn't offended. She said cheerily,
Well, the way it works is, you don't have to believe in it for it to be true.
Bibi saw, among other things in the bag, a Sig Sauer P220, or maybe a P226. She recognized the weapon because the P226, chambered for 9mm ammunition, was the standard pistol issued to SEALs. Paxton had purchased his own P220 because it was chambered for .45 caliber and more likely to knock a bad guy down hard in close combat. The two guns looked all but identical. Bibi had her own P226, which Paxton had taught her to use, an engagement gift. The uneasiness about Kalida, which Bibi had shaken off, now crept up on her once more. Why the gun? Kalida took a pistol from the suitcase and put it on the table.
Divination creates the psychic equivalent of seismic waves, shock waves. The vast majority of people can't feel them or don't realize what they're feeling, but certain people can feel them and sometimes locate the source.
What certain people?
The wrong people. That's all you need to know. Mostly they let me alone. They've learned better than to mess with Kalida Butterfly.
Because eccentric people and the details of their obsessions were good material for fiction, Bibi was genuinely interested when she asked, Do you have silver bullets in the gun? Taking from the suitcase a bottle of rubbing alcohol, a small roll of inch-wide gauze, and a self-dispensing roll of adhesive tape, Kalida said,
Didn't figure you for the kind of writer who would leap to a cliche. Good old American ammo will do the job.
Bibi settled into one of the chairs, holding her wine glass in both hands. What's your real name?
Kalida Butterfly, believe it or not.
I'll buy the Kalida, but who were you before Butterfly?
Okay, you've got me. I am caught, revealed. Before I was Kalida Butterfly, I was, of course, Kalida Caterpillar.
The masseuse diviner placed a small packet, twice the size of a matchbook, beside the rubbing alcohol, and then turned to rummage in the suitcase once more. Bibi reached across the table, picked up this newest item, a seamstress's kit of needles in a variety of sizes. Replacing the packet where she'd found it, she said, "What are you going to sew?"
"Flesh."
The answer required another question, but Bibi didn't ask it. A session of fortune-telling, though pointless, had seemed to promise a little fun. But moment by moment, the weirdness mounted and the mood grew darker. Nancy and Murphy had gotten involved with some strange people over the years, but most of them were harmless surf dudes who had been clamshelled, prosecuted, and thoroughly rinse-cycled by so many monster waves that their common sense had been washed out of them. Kalida didn't seem crazy in a dangerous way, but she didn't seem to be as tightly wound as a new spool of thread either. The last things the woman took from her bag were a folded white cotton cloth, a silver bowl, and a flannel sack with contents that rattled softly when she put it down. "I didn't know my parents were into this. I mean, they never want to think about the future. You know, it'll be what it'll be." Kalida sat, picked up her glass, and poured half the wine down her throat as if she had no interest in the taste of it.
"Like I said, divination isn't only fortune-telling."
"Oh, that's right. It's also for uncovering hidden knowledge by supernatural means. What knowledge did Mom and Dad want uncovered?"
"You're a nice kid, but you're nosy. I would no more divulge my experiences with other clients than a priest would tell you what someone said in confession."
Bibi felt rebuked, but to no degree embarrassed. "When did you go into this divination business?" Rather than answer, Kalida finished the rest of her Chardonnay in one long swallow. She put down the empty glass and met Bibi's stare, and seemed to want to see how long her client could tolerate silence between them. Candlelight ceaselessly fingered her face, as if trying to lift the shadows that veiled part of it. Earlier, the color of her eyes had seemed to fluctuate, depending on the angle at which the light entered them, but now they were a steady green, and striated in such a way that they reminded Bibi of the eyes of the tiger cub that her parents had given her. After picking up the bottle and refilling her wine glass, Kalida at last answered the question.
"I started 27 years ago. I was 16. My mother taught me."
"What's your mother's name?"
"Thalia. Thalia Butterfly."
"Butterfly and butterfly. So it's a two-diviner practice, like mother-daughter attorneys or something."
"My mother died 12 years ago, and it wasn't an easy death."
Although Bibi didn't know what to believe, she nonetheless felt bad for having been flippant. "I'm sorry. What happened?"
"One night, after a session like this, the wrong people showed up. They tortured and then dismembered her. If you think that's just a story, you can check it out online. The crime was never solved."
Chapter 34, The Eye of the Needle. Astragalomancy was a method of divining the future or learning hidden knowledge by rolling dice. A ceromancer dropped melted wax into cold water and interpreted the figures thus produced. Halomancy required the reading of the shapes made by casting a handful of salt on a flat surface. A necromancer sought answers by communicating with the dead. When Kalida pulled the drawstring on the small flannel bag and spilled the familiar lettered tiles onto the dinette table, she said,
"My mother devised and perfected the occult art of Scrabblemancy."
Bibi almost laughed, but then she remembered the brutal murder and dismemberment that could be researched online. She swallowed the laugh and washed it down with a sip of wine to conceal how close she had come to giving offense. Even in such vain and silly pursuits as divination, you could unwittingly encounter a sociopath and become the object of her wrath. In fact, the more fruitless and outré the subject of your interest, the more likely it might be that those without a moral compass and with a taste for violence, empty and wandering in search of convictions, might cross your path. Besides, she didn't want to hurt Kalida's feelings.
"We are told that in the beginning was the word," Kalida said, "and that the world, the entire universe, was spoken into existence. My mother speculated that the best material with which a diviner could work would be words, not human entrails or lines in your palm or a handful of salt cast on a table, but words. And if words existed before matter of any kind, before suns and worlds and seas and human beings and fortune tellers, well, then an alphabet must have existed even earlier, so that words could be formed. Therefore, letters are more fundamental and powerful than anything else a diviner could use to force the secrets of the universe into view. Now, I'm going to ask you a question, B.B. Blair, and you must answer truthfully, frankly, because I'll conduct the session in different ways depending on your response. Does Scrabblemancy make sense to you? Not, do you believe it will work, but does it make sense? And to what degree?
When Kalida leaned into the table, tilting her head toward Bibi, her blonde hair shimmered forward and flared slightly to each side of her face, like golden wings. And her eyes were disconcerting in their hawkish intensity and predatory focus. As much as Bibi wanted to like the woman, moments such as this made her feel as though they had been born on different worlds and could never fully relate to each other.
"Does the theory make sense, and to what degree?" Kalida repeated in a whisper.
And in the glass cups on the table, candles popped and hissed as the flames found impurities in the wicks, as if the melting wax were speaking in sympathy with the diviner. "It makes a little sense. I mean, in the context of divination," Bibi said, striving to be truthful without being dismissive. "But I'm more interested in things being spoken into existence than I could ever possibly be in using the occult to discover hidden knowledge."
"What if things spoken into existence, who spoke them and why, is the same thing as hidden knowledge?"
"But I don't believe they are," Bibi replied. The hawk-eyed diviner seemed to search the depths of Bibi's eyes as a real hawk, gliding in its gyre, would scrutinize a meadow far below, seeking a mouse to hunt down and snatch up. Then she sat back in her chair, and the wings of flaxen hair closed against her face, once more curtaining her ears. She drank from the refilled glass, again finishing half the wine in one long swallow. When she put down the glass, she said,
"Did you lock the front door when you came in?"
Bibi nodded, "Yes."
"Is there a second door?"
"No."
"Are the windows locked?"
"Yes."
"Then let's begin and finish quickly. The less time we're at it, the safer we'll be."
As the diviner swiped the Scrabble tiles off the table and into the silver bowl, rings sparkling with candlelight, Bibi sipped the wine and savored it, considering whether her parents would be insulted if she refused the second part of their gift and sent this woman away. Kalida returned the bowl to the table. From the seamstress's packet, she selected the largest needle, held it in a candle flame, and then placed it on the folded white cotton cloth. She removed the cap from the rubbing alcohol, stuck the thumb of her left hand into the bottle, let it soak for a minute, and then screwed the cap on once more. When the diviner picked up the 2-inch needle with her right hand, Bibi said, "You're not serious." As she began speaking softly in a language that Bibi didn't recognize, Kalida thrust the needle through the plump pad of her own thumb, not through the nail, but behind it. The crown with its eye protruded from one side of the thumb, the gleaming point from the other, and about a third of the shank couldn't be seen because it was buried in the flesh. "Why the hell did you do that?" Bibi demanded, as blood oozed from the entrance and exit wounds and dripped onto the cotton cloth. Kalida spoke a few more words in the arcane language and then, through clenched teeth, hissed in distress before answering,
"Your skepticism prevents you from being involved enough for this to work. So I have to be more intently focused to compensate for your doubt. Nothing focuses the mind quite like pain.
This is nuts.
If you keep up your useless commentary, the diviner warned, I'll have to put a second needle through the meat of my palm.
Not if we stop this right now.
Bibi pushed her chair back from the table. Kalida grimaced.
We've begun the session. We must complete it. Close the door I've opened. Or those psychic shockwaves I mentioned earlier won't stop. They're a beacon, an irresistible summons. You'll have visitors you do not want.
Bibi's skepticism wasn't absolute. The piercing needle and the blood argued for Kalida's sincerity, if not for her sanity. After a hesitation, Bibi sat. She pulled her chair closer to the table. Her mother and father hadn't become strangers to her because of their interest in divination and this bizarre gift. The fullness of her love hadn't diminished whatsoever. Her comfortable image of them, however, was evidently an inadequate likeness, and her long-held assumptions about their interior lives now seemed deficient, immature, if not naive. Stirring her right hand through the wooden tiles in the silver bowl, Kalida seemed to speak to an invisible presence.
I bleed for answers. I cannot be denied. Attend me.
To Bibi, she said,
How many letters should I draw?
I don't know. How would I know?
You've got to participate, girl. How many letters?
Bibi looked at the kitchen window above the sink and was only somewhat relieved to see that indeed it had been locked.
11, she said,
though she had no reason why that number and not another.
11 letters.
Chapter 35, A World and a Half Away. Paxton and Danny didn't believe in ghosts. Perry allowed for the possibility, but never expected to see one. Only Gibb was as certain of the reality of unmoored spirits as he was of the existence of the air he breathed, for his mother, who had raised him alone, sometimes saw his dead father walking in the fields behind their house, or standing under the oak tree in the yard, or sitting on the porch, smiling and translucent. On those occasions, she said it made sense that dear Harry would decline to move on as souls should, considering that he had loved her and Gibb as no man had ever before loved his wife and son. Gibb never glimpsed the apparition, though he yearned to see it. He knew it must be real, because his mother never lied. And each time she saw the wraith, she grew luminous with delight. Yet none of the four seals, including open-minded Perry and true-believing Gibb, felt that this town in the barren outback of hell might be haunted. If any place in the world should have made you feel that it lay aswarm with otherworldly presences, it should have been this doomed village. But perhaps the cruelties visited upon these people had been so demonic and vicious, the murders committed with such cold-blooded pleasure and violence, that the many victims had been killed twice, in body and in spirit, and had no choice of either an afterlife or a lingering haunt. At 3 a.m., when the seals had left their surveillance post on the roof, moving into the narrow streets with a stealth that only ghosts could have matched, the town seemed never to have supported life, to have been forever as dead as any crater on the airless moon that shed now only a quarter of its potential light. The dwellings were crammed together, each walled from its neighbors, curiously isolated in proximity to the others, segregated, crude and sullen-looking places, lacking any sense of comfort or community, each family a separate tribe on its own speck of an archipelago, so that no aura of history adhered to the structures either. Nor did they serve even as monuments to those who had once inhabited them. Pax wondered if this deadest of dead places would be the death of him, but he didn't dwell on the thought. Difficult as it might be for civilians to believe, a battle-hardened seal valued his life less than the lives of his buddies, less even than his honor, which was the only attitude to have if he wanted to win a war. They had split into two teams and had circuitously approached the target house by using the streets that paralleled the one onto which it faced. Pax and Perry entered, from behind, a damaged building that stood across from what might be Abdullah al-Ghazali's nest. They took 15 minutes to ease through the walled and debris-strewn backyard and through the ruined interior to the front door, which had been blown off in an attack 17 months earlier. Crouching just inside the doorway, they studied the house across the street from this closer vantage point, wearing night vision gear, and confirmed what they had seen previously with periscopic cameras and binoculars. The structure was intact, except for pockmarks and divots chipped out by bullets, all the windows protected by exterior metal shutters. Instead of mud bricks plastered over with stucco, the house appeared to be more modern, constructed of reinforced concrete, not an uncommon preference in a country where unending sectarian and tribal warfare, once fought with rifles, had long ago escalated to machine guns and rocket-propelled grenades. At 5:11 a.m., the mission-specific satellite phone in Paxton's jacket pocket vibrated. The caller could be only Perry, who, with Gibb, had taken up a position on the roof of the building to the east of the target house, with a view of its backyard. Perry spoke softly.
Faint interior light, leaking around a shutter. Just now.
This served to confirm that the cigarette smoker on the roof, seen the previous afternoon,